You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
So it's Derek Davison and Danny Besner, which can only mean one thing. It's a crossover Non-Zero American Prissies podcast. I am Robert Wright of Non-Zero. And this is going to be actually kind of impromptu foreign policy conversation. We didn't realize we were going to talk about foreign policy. We just taped a conversation that will appear on the American Prestige feed, which is about a book that I'm too shy to plug, but is called The God Test, Artificial Intelligence and Our Coming Cosmic Reckoning, and you should rush out and buy it. But again, I'm not prone to self-promotion, but it was a great conversation because I got so much pushback, predictably, from Danny especially.
I don't think you did. I don't think you got pushback at all. Let's save another one. I don't think you got pushback at all. My only actual criticism is I think capitalism is mentioned only once, and that to me seems
it's the subtext. Do you not know subtext when you see it, Danny Besner? So anyway,
this
now
is 2026,
we're
brother. We don't do subtext anymore.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'm an older guy. This is about foreign policy and probably mostly about Iran. And I'm going to start by asking you guys to get me up to speed because I've been paying attention. And in fact, maybe a good way to start out is to give you my rudimentary understanding of recent events. And then you can correct me and or elaborate. But I've been kind of immersed in book promotion. The war is kind of back on again. It's hard to say. I mean, it starts kind of with Iran wanting to assert that it is actually in control of the Strait of Hormuz. And if any ships try to get out of the strait without checking in with Iranian authorities, steering over to that part of the strait and checking in, that it may launch a drone strike or something against them. I don't think anybody's been killed, but it's the kind of thing that would terrify an insurance company enough to eventually slow or stop traffic in the Strait of Hormuz. It's asserting that right. There's a separate issue about whether it's charging money in the tolls. And we can get into the extent to which either of these should or should not have been anticipated based on the memorandum of understanding. But in any event, Trump didn't like it, struck back. Iran struck back to the strike back, but hit a couple of bases in the region. And then the last I heard, Trump had struck back yet again and said, oh, I think the ceasefire is kind of over, although maybe we'll keep talking. But anyway, these Iranians are scum. I mean, more like the leaders are scum and whatever. What is the story? Well, you guys are probably more updated and knowledgeable.
Well, Derek certainly is, so I'll leave this one to double D squared over here.
Yeah, I mean, this has happened a few times, this back and forth, like strike Iran strikes back. Maybe they do it for two or three nights in a row. Two, I think, is as far as it's gotten to date, but I suspect we're going to go longer this time. This happened a few times, like since the MOU, and it's based on, you want to get into the MOU on the vague wording of the MOU, which is as vague as possible because that's the way they got an agreement, like was by, you know, making this, something that, both sides could read their own, points into. But as a result of that, they have a dispute over managing the strait. And the Iranians have been frustrated particularly with ships that aren't coordinating their passage through the strait with Tehran, who are using the waterway that goes around the Omani coast, runs very close to the Omani coast, that's outside of Iran's territorial waters. The Iranians don't like that. And so they've periodically attacked ships that are using that route, arguing that they have the right to control traffic in the strait. What's new this week is not only, as you said, Bob, that Trump sort of unilaterally declared the ceasefire to be over or decided it's probably over, although we might keep negotiating, but really I don't want to deal with the Iranians anymore and it's a waste of time, et cetera, all the things that he said when he was in Turkey. But also the U.S. withdrew its waiver on Iranian oil sanctions, which hadn't really come into effect yet. I mean, you know, it was just very little of this MOU has actually had a chance to breathe. Mm-hmm. But this is one of the main pillars of the MOU, was that Iran for 60 days while they negotiate a grand bargain, in theory, would be allowed to sell oil, and there would be no restrictions on, you know, not just the oil industry, but banking and shipping and insurance, all the things that you need to do to sell oil in addition to pumping it and refining it. So pulling that like rips the guts out of the MOU anyway. And now it's unclear, you know, as I say, between that and Trump saying the MOU is over, the question is like, what is there to get anybody back to the negotiating table, or even to get people to stop doing this kind of back and forth nightly exchange of fire? And I don't know that there is anything, but Danny, I know you wanted to
I want to, because like we will have done a news episode on this, so our listeners will have already heard a lot of this. But Bob, in sort of inspired by your book, The God Test, why don't we go a little bit cosmic? And we don't often do this with you. What do you think this means for U.S. foreign policy? Because to my mind, it's that this is like actually might be an epochal shift. Because I think it shows that the age of drone warfare is fully here. And a lot of the military industrial plant that the United States has invested in is just not suited for this new age, and raises large questions about power projection, American bases. But I'm curious, from like a 50,000 foot view, what do you think this means, more broadly speaking, than we usually talk about between us?
Oh, I think it's a big shift of power toward Iran. And, you know, some people are just having trouble wrapping their mind around this. I mean, you know, people complain, oh, Trump got such a bad deal. You're hearing this also from liberals, by the way, Democrats who want to score points on Trump and probably believe it. But it's like, what kind of deal do you expect him to get given the position he put himself in by launching this war? Because the key thing that happened, and it is related to drones, I think the drones kind of intensified the effect and maybe made the key difference, but the new technology generally. But, you know, people long said, you know, Iran could try to, you know, stop traffic in the Strait of Hormuz. Well, they finally actually did it. And I think that's... to some extent, it's that contingent fact, right? Like, we gave them the excuse to do it. And although I think they should focus on this a lot more in their messaging, if I were them, we violated international law in the most fundamental way, by my lights possible, violated the UN Charter, clear, unprovoked transport or aggression. So for us to whine about them violating in the sense of, you know, by charging tolls, violating a different part of international law is a little odd. I mean, the thing, by the way, is a tangent that I would do if I were in messaging wise is I would say, look, this was flatly illegal. You did hundreds of billions of dollars worth of damage. You owe us the money, and we're just going to collect tolls until either you give us the money and we'll stop. We'll be happy to stop. Just send us $300 billion. Or we're going to keep collecting them until we get up to $300 billion. That is something people can understand, and it underscores how illegal the war was. But look, I'm not in charge of Iranian messaging. And one reason I would like to, it's not that I'm more pro-Iranian than I am pro-American. I'm just like pro kind of peace and stability. And I think in principle, the new leverage Iran is illustrating here, and you're right, like, that first of all, they did finally do, we gave them such a good excuse to do what people long said they do, that that's now just a fact, and we got to deal with the fact they can do it. And also, the drone technology makes it much easier to enforce. Like, people are saying, you know, Trump should muscle up and go in and clean this fucking thing out. Hey, they can launch a drone from all kinds of places in the country that will send fear into, you know, any insurance company that insures these tankers. It's like, you know, I think Trump would have to invade on the ground to stop this. And there's still not enough recognition of the fact that that is the current power dynamic. So anyway, back to your question, Iran now just has this leverage. And as long as, at least, they are willing to return to war, right? In other words, as long as every time Trump punishes them militarily for hitting one of these tankers that refuses to go through their checkpoint, if they are willing to hit back, and I think you may see them hitting back harder because the token responses don't seem to have been enough for Trump. If they're willing to return to war and they can keep credibly signaling that, and it's true, Trump is just in a very, just in terms of basic game theory, he's fucked. Because for domestic political reasons, he does not want to return to full-scale war. He doesn't want the oil prices there. So just in the short term, there's that shift in power dynamics. But we've also learned a lot of other things that help, you know, make this bode a longer-term shift. Like, you know those American bases in the Gulf states? Like, they're just sitting ducks. It's like the first thing we did was withdraw all the troops from them after, you know, as soon as Iran struck back. Like, So as of now technology evolves, you get countermeasures and so on. But, you know, the Gulf states have learned, and some of them are taking this to heart and some of them less so, but that not only do the military bases not stop you from getting attacked by Iran, they make you get attacked by Iran, right? And so... that's fundamental that, you know, we've got all these bases and all these countries are like, wait, these are not a defensive asset, these American military bases. Now, I guess the UAE, and we could, Derek knows more about this than me. I guess the UAE is, is still sticking with Team U.S. Israel, but there are, and I'm not up to speed on this, but there seem to be varying degrees of rethinking by many of the Gulf states about the extent to which they want to stay on Team America, Israel, and be on super bad terms with Iran. I mean, you tell me.
This is the big question. I mean, and this is the big question of domestic politics almost, as we all know. I mean, Bob, you don't talk about the Israel lobby enough, but I think that you in the center... need to really focus. No, but I think that this is really the big question of American politics in 2028 when it comes to foreign relations, is to what degree is this going to be a more institutional shift away from the special relationship with Israel, or and to what degree it's not going to be. And I think that unclear, my guess it's going to be, it seems to be so broad spectrum for people under 40, 45. It seems hard to imagine that it wouldn't be such a shift, but that remains to be seen. And the other question, I'd love to get your thoughts on that as well, both of you guys, is that to me, the biggest upshot of this has even less to do with the Middle East and the Strait of Hormuz, even though that's very important. But like you said, the bases in the Middle East are sitting ducks. What are the bases in South Korea? What are the bases around on the first island chain with China? I mean, to me, this is the big strategic takeaway. If you're a Chinese military analyst, you're like, they can't project power. They just can't do it. And my oft-repeated line is, China sends 1 billion drones at an aircraft carrier. What are you going to do? Not 1 billion, 1 million. Mm-hmm. 1 million drones, which is feasible. Like, you can't defend against that. So I'd love to get your thoughts on those two things as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, of course, the geography and the balance of power, all these things are different in the Pacific. But, you know, the basic, I think one lesson is, you know, aircraft carriers are just not the dominant thing they used to be. There are more ways to hit them. And I'm sure they have pretty good defensive systems. I mean, it's interesting, Iran, aside from a few missiles that were maybe signaling early on, they haven't really made an attempt, for example, to use hypersonic missiles or anything. So we don't know what they could be doing, if they could be doing more, but I guarantee you that when it comes to like drone swarm technology, not something China has been overlooking for the last 5 years. And since they make the best drones on the American, you know, we don't, they make the best drones And, you know, I think I saw on this 4th of July, was there a big American like use of drones to do something vivid in the sky? Like China did that. I remember like 5 years ago, I tweeted like, whoa, can we, China did something just fucking mind blowing with drones, just decoratively, like thousands, hundreds, if not thousands of drones. And I remember tweeting like, you know, is it too soon to surrender in Cold War II? It was awesome. These guys, I think there's every reason. Look, my view, like I think yours was already, there's no way America wins a war over Taiwan in the long run. I mean, even if they win the first round, like it just means a lot more to China. It's a lot closer to them. There's no way. And one thing I think Iran signals is given the new technological developments, that's even truer than before. So meanwhile, of course, we are restricting the export of chips from the Taiwanese factories in a way that reduces the disincentive of China right. to attack Taiwan.
And I mean, there's another way to look at what Iran has done and take lessons that could be useful for Taiwan in how one holds off a major power that's trying to attack one's territory and makes it, is trying to defeat, you know, a country, a less powerful country in a war, and how you make that so painful for the great power that they don't have the ability to do that anymore. Like there are things you could learn from what Iran is doing that Taiwan could apply to its own situation, I think. But that doesn't seem to be happening, or if it is going to happen, it's not happening on a short time frame for sure.
Yeah. So in answer to your question, Andy, it feels pretty fundamental to me. And of course, fairly large parts of the American foreign policy establishment are in one stage or another of denial, or in denial to one degree or another about the magnitude of this. Look, I'm not saying
you couldn't
keep a robust military force there, but it'll be fascinating to see the interplay of the two things we've now alluded to. One is the actual changing balance of power in the Middle East. And by the way, there's a thought I didn't finish. I think it's actually good for peace and stability in the world if Iran has a deterrent to would-be aggressors that consists of something other than attacking Israel, right? Like, that is in some ways a good thing. You know, I mean, the most peaceful version of that would be an actual toll booth that was accepted, and they would just say, okay, in response to this or that aggression, we're shutting off this or that. But in any event, for all the fireworks right now, and I don't minimize them, and I worry about what's next, it's less incendiary than them attacking Israel with missiles, which is the main threat. I mean, that's how we got into this, is because they had the proxies, right? But once the proxies were out of the picture or significantly disempowered after October 7th, the only threat Iran had was this dramatic threat of actually attacking Israel. And everybody's thinking, well, you're not going to do that, so we'll just fuck with you more and more. Well, they finally fucked with them so much. I mean, first of all, even in June when they attacked Iran directly, and at that point, Iran's got to do something. And now, this time, it's not bad for them to have this kind of leverage in the Strait of Hormuz. But anyway, the two things you mentioned, the actual change in the balance of power in the region and this change in American politics, it will be fascinating to watch the interaction. You guys had a really good conversation you just posted with the guys at the American Conservative, Kurt Mills and Andrew Day, where you got into this. And all four of you know more about it probably than I do, I genuinely don't know what's going to happen. I'm not convinced that anything dramatic is going to happen in American politics. It's like, you know, when Rahm Emanuel starts criticizing Bibi Netanyahu, folks, that's not a revolution. He's doing that so he doesn't have to criticize Israel. Would you agree with that?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. It's, 100%.
It's a con. Yeah. This
liberal Zionist move.
There's a few things that are still the playbook. One is, you know, bringing up the two-state solution, which is just a punt at this point because it's not possible. And of course, Rahm's speech the other day, in Israel. He's now like trumpeting this idea of the 23-state solution, which includes all the Arab states, which is just a rehash of the Arab Peace Initiative. But he's portraying it as some like big innovative thing because you can just say it and it sounds clever. It sounds like, oh, the 23-state solution, how sophisticated. Like the real answer is, yeah, the 23-state solution, because the Israelis have divided up the West Bank so much that there are 23 Bantustans for the Palestinians to live on. But like it doesn't mean anything. It's just empty rhetoric. And they do the same thing with Netanyahu. They telescope everything onto Benjamin Netanyahu, and he's the bad guy, or he and his right. cabinet are the bad guys, and they're the lone bad actors here. And if we just get rid of them, everything will be hunky-dory. Like the two people who are most likely to replace Netanyahu if he loses, if his coalition loses this next election, are Naftali Bennett and Gadi Eisenkot. And both of them have been running effectively on the premise that they will be more effective at genociding the Palestinians or ethnically cleansing the Palestinians from the territories than he has been. There mm-hmm. is no alternative in Israeli politics to that position, that the Palestinians have to go one way or the other. And to pretend otherwise is, yeah, to just like you want to avoid criticizing Israel, so you create this fiction that it's one bad apple or five yeah. bad apples, and, yep. and that's the problem. Or it's the settler movement, which then allows Netanyahu to go with the settlers acting on their own accord. It's not, they don't get any state support. Oh, yeah. There's no institutional backing. It's just these bad settlers, which then lets Netanyahu go on CNN and say, oh, it's just 150 juvenile delinquents who go around and attack these Palestinian towns, which is absolute horseshit, but it's allowed to pass because, again, it lets you focus attention. You're jingling a shiny object and saying, look here, don't look at the real problem. That's what it is.
Yeah, there have been videos for a long time of IDF soldiers actually aiding and abetting. You know, there was a video we posted on Non-Zero several years ago of like an IDF soldier basically keeping watch while a settler torched a car in a garage that belonged to a Palestinian. And, on the Netanyahu thing, it's funny, you know, Alex Gibney did this documentary on Bibi's legal troubles, which is very good, called The Bibi Files. And I had him on to talk about, I had Alex on to talk about this on the podcast. And at that point, he was running into distribution problems that a cynic might suggest were being facilitated by pro-Israel forces. But in any event, I would imagine now AIPAC is probably subsidizing the distribution of that thing, because now, you know, the great hope in, you know, such a politics shifted that the great hope in pro-Israel circles is to make Bibi the scapegoat. I mean, I'm exaggerating, of course. AIPAC, its official mandate is to basically represent the Israel interests of the Israeli government. It's open about that. That's the charter, kind of. But yeah, Bibi, criticizing Bibi is not the radically progressive thing to do, I would say.
Guys, I got to go. Derek, you want to collect the audio and then you could do another 10 minutes?
Okay, so you ready?
Yeah, whenever you want.
Okay, so now that Danny's gone, should we talk about Danny or keep talking about Iran?
When he's gone, it's always good to get out whatever you're feeling about him.
There's a lot that I need to get out about Danny. How long do you have?
Yeah, maybe we should make that a separate
okay,
episode.
Okay, we'll do a special Danny episode. We'll call it Impervious to Reason.
That sounds good. That sounds good. Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, there's other stuff going on in the world, but what else do you... You know, you guys were having an interesting conversation in that American Conservative podcast about whether there will be a true realignment on Israel in either party, if so, which one, and ultimately, could that be part of a larger restructuring of coalitions, you know, that's fundamental. I think you're skeptical of that part. You're skeptical of the...
I am, yeah.
Of the idea that the anti-war tendencies of MAGA right and, you know, far-ish left could lead to some kind of unified political movement across the board that, you know, covers so many dimensions, including domestic policy, that you could wind up with a...
Yeah, they just run in such different directions. I think it could only be an alliance of convenience on one or another particular issue. And like we're not even there yet because they just don't have the numbers, right? I mean, even on Israel, like you don't have the numbers in Congress yet to really even stop this, you know, Section 219 thing or whatever number they've assigned to it now, the Defense Authorization Act, where they want to, you know, merge the U.S. and Israeli militaries, which is just insane to me.
So what is that deal? I read a little about it. The idea is that, okay, we'll quit paying for weapons we send to Israel. Meanwhile, though, we're going to do this other thing, and that's what you're talking about?
Yeah, we're going to do, like, joint development and joint research and development on, you know, anything that basically has to do with modern warfare. So drones, AI, you know, any modern battlefield cyber, whatever it is. I mean, there's a ton of things that are outlined in there that pretty much run the gamut. And the U.S. and Israeli militaries would basically just be, you know, kind of joined at the hip in terms of research and development. So it would eliminate the need to send Israel any military aid because we're just all going to be in one big pot doing things together. And it includes things like we did an interview on this on our YouTube channel. Like it includes things like data sharing. I mean, you know, theoretically, you can have information that the U.S. gleans from doing joint exercises with some unrelated country or, you know, in NATO or something that winds up being shared with the Israelis if there's no firewall there. You could just have general data sharing between the two countries, which is like terrifying on some level. It's dystopian. But all of that stuff would be done jointly, yeah.
So this is something Israel would much prefer to the current situation where we pay for some weapons,
yeah,
but we don't
absolutely.
Do this.
Absolutely. I mean, like the level, even the theoretical level of oversight that goes into military aid as it's done right now is, you know, potentially a problem for the Israelis. I mean, it's never actually a problem because when the rubber hits the road, as it did with the Biden administration, you find some way to absolve the Israelis of, you know, their war crimes or to excuse it or just ignore it and hand wave it away. But still, it exists on paper, at least, that you have things like the Leahy laws and, you know, other mechanisms that are supposed to dictate, you know, a certain respect for international law or humanitarian law when you're using U.S. weapons that could be a problem, theoretically. This would eliminate that. If you did away with the aid, then they don't have to worry about that. They can buy weapons if they want to. Israel has plenty of money to do that. That comes with much less control. And then, this Section 219, I think 219 is the designation now was 224 at one point, and then they changed it. That would just eliminate any firewall. Like it's just all one thing. You're working together.
So there was enough political opposition to 224 that they changed the number to 219.
I don't know if they did it just to. I mean, it was somewhere in the process of like the House NDAA and the Senate NDAA coming together. I don't know if they tried to slip it past everybody by changing the number.
Do you know how it took shape? Like who were the original sponsors or where, what like think tank generated the documents or whatever? Or
I don't know in that level of detail. That's sometimes somebody who does more work on Congress would have to unpack that. But I mean, I think... you know, it's something that's being pushed by defense contractors. It's by being pushed by because, of course, you know, they would get extra goodies out of this because the Israelis would be contributing or asking for more stuff, which helps the defense industry with its work. It also and this is one of the things we talked about with Ben Freeman, who we interviewed. It also would give the Israeli government the ability to claim the same thing that the defense contractors in the U.S. do, which is that we're creating jobs in your congressional district. So the Israelis could go to Congress and say, like, look, we're intimately involved in developing these systems that create X number of jobs in your district. So yeah. You can't cut, you know, you can't give us any, you know, scrutiny or try to cut back on these things because it's, scrutinize the U.S.-Israel relationship in any way because, that's a political risk for you, even on a level beyond what the Israel lobby is able to do now with campaign finance and, just straight up money.
This is a genius level maneuver. Are there signs that there's enough opposition to it to stop it?
I don't think so.
Really?
I don't think so. I mean, there were efforts to get 224 out of the House version and they failed. So I don't think this is likely to stay in. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that they really factor in like the radicalizing effect this has on certain segments. It's like, I mean, Nick Fuentes is going to go to town on this shit.
Right.
If this passes, it's like, you should buy stock in his like YouTube or whatever the fuck it is, because his numbers are not going to drop. And that's what, I don't know if they don't get it or they don't care. It's like, they're just kind of heightening the contradictions.
I think the idea is they don't want to have to care, right? So you want to embed this relationship so strongly that it doesn't matter mm-hmm. if, you know, a genuine anti-Israel politics achieves some level of functionality in the U.S., there's nothing that really can be done about it. Or to do anything about it would require so much effort that they could be sure that even like a rump, Senate block could prevent it from happening or something like that. The idea is to make it kind of foolproof or to make it politics proof, I think, in that sense.
It's funny. I thought, after the Iran war was such a disaster and like even the New York Times was basically writing the story like BB got us to do this was almost the headline,
Right.
Israel got us into the war. I thought, so finally BB has overplayed his hand, right? Like, and you're hearing, hey, we're not going to pay for arms for Israel, blah, blah, blah. And now this, and you think not even this was overplaying his hand. You add in mm-hmm. the hugely disproportionate response in Gaza and getting, getting us into this war and everything else. And he still has not, for political purposes, overplayed. Now, he may wind up in the weeds, right?
Because if you pair that with, here's this $3.8 billion in aid that we're not going to give Israel anymore. Hooray, we get all that money back. And then embedded in, some piece of legislation in the National Defense Authorization Act, like, here's this other thing that actually, intensifies the military cooperation, the military relationship between these two countries. But that's buried somewhere in a document that, reporters are less likely to get to and that the public is less likely to know about than this big, pot of money that's not going to Israel anymore. You can try to, hide it in that sense. Mm-hmm. I think that's what they're doing here. But to me, when you have Netanyahu and Lindsey Graham and Rahm Emanuel and, Democratic Majority for Israel, like all of these forces saying, yeah, it's time to cut U.S. military aid, get rid of U.S. military aid to Israel. Like, you have to know that there's something else going on, even if it's behind the scenes. Like, these guys are not just, having an epiphany. Like, they know what they're doing and they know what they're trying to achieve.
I mean, but again, the effect on extremism, you used to kind of not, part of the speech code used to be you couldn't say that anything Israel does contributes to anti-Semitism or the expression of anti-Semitism in America. I think that's kind of over because like Tom Friedman has kind of said it in his column. He said like Bibi is imperiling Jews around the world. But I'm afraid it's true. And the idea that, just to be clear, to say that it has that effect is not to conflate Zionism with Judaism or anything else. It's to say that, here's the way the dynamics of anti-Semitism work, A, and B, there is a lot of conflation in those circles between, you know, Jews and Israelis or Israel and Judaism, whatever else. They're making the conflation that adds to the impact, to the fuel that this kind of thing provides them. And it's just a thing. And this is not good. I mean, as Tom said, he wasn't talking about this particular policy. But, you know, Bibi hasn't been, as they used to say, good for the Jews. And it's just fucking, you know, I guess, you know, that, you know, maybe he'll try to make the best of, I don't know, Bibi or whoever wants to make the best of this too by saying, oh, now there's more anti-Semitism and we'll have to crack down more on pro-Palestinian speech or something. I don't know. But this is not, there's just so many things in this country that don't seem to be headed in a positive direction. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's a race. I mean, they feel like Netanyahu, really the whole Israeli establishment. We, you know, as I said, there's no meaningful like anti-occupation force in Israeli politics anymore. I mean, there are elements, but they don't have any, you know, kind of real presence in the Knesset or ability to do anything. Like, I think they feel like they're in a race. They see what's happening to public opinion in the United States, and they want to get to a place. And you know, similarly to, you know, similar, I think, in relations with the Arab world and trying to get, you know, normal relations with Saudi Arabia, which has been the big prize for a while now. It's a question of, like, can we eliminate the Palestinians effectively? Can we shunt them into... you know, Bantu stands, or get rid of them entirely. You know, send them all to Somaliland or wherever the destination of choice is at this point. In a quick enough time to avoid to make it a fait accompli. By the time there's a real political reckoning in the U.S., it's a done deal. There's nothing anybody can do about it. And then, you know, it becomes a waiting game with the Arabs. Like, how long do we have to wait after we achieve that aim before we can go to the Saudis and say, hey, look, this is water under the bridge. Let's do a deal here.
Yeah,
and
but
I think it's all a question of timing at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's gruesome to imagine the kind of end state that gets them to that point, right? Like, the Palestinian issue is behind us. Like, what does that look like? Yeah. I mean, actual expulsion of Gazans into Egypt, or what in the West Bank? I mean, I don't. Do you have a scenario? Like, I've, at what point, I mean, does they it were, become they this were, waiting game?
They've been talking to, you know, the largely unrecognized Israel's the only country that recognizes a government in Somaliland. They've talked to other countries, you know, but all supposedly told them no. But about
they actually export what they, the what, Palestinians.
What
there?
They keep terming voluntary relocation, which is basically, can we make life so unbearable? And already have, really, in Gaza, that people will agree to go someplace else. And then once they've gone someplace else, it's somebody else's problem. It's not, you know, it doesn't matter if we have a Palestinian state or Palestinian self-determination of any kind, because there's no Palestinian population left. They all went somewhere else.
Well, now what do you want to do? If that's the plan, the good news for Israel would be that, as you guys said on that podcast with Kurt and Andrew, well, I'm not sure how much of this you did. Well, you did say that, like, the human rights part of the Palestinian issue is less of an issue on the right wing, you know, objection to America's Israel policy than on the left wing part. And so I guess, you know, if you assume that Dick Fuentes represents, if you assume that the more virulent part of the reaction to Israel and the more anti-Semitic part is on the right, although that's not the assumption of people like Bill Ackman, who, you know, want to put, you know, campus pro-Palestinian protesters somewhere other than campus, I guess, if you assume that, I guess it's easier to imagine them getting away with something that radical in on the American political landscape. And I guess eventually Saudi Arabia comes around. It's pretty grim. Now, right now, I mean, you would think, look, if their goal is really to cozy up to Saudi Arabia, you know, at the moment, you think they got a funny way of showing it, because in the near term, this only makes it harder for Saudi Arabia to, right, to warm up to Israel. And I'm, you know, I'm curious in general about what your, we didn't quite get around to this, but what your view is of the future landscape in the Arab world. As I said, UAE seems pretty much on team Israel-America, right? Like,
yeah.
And going forward, yes, it's not as clear maybe for any of the other Arab states that that's the case as it is for UAE. And with what states is it the most clear that that doesn't seem to be the near-term destiny and they're going to do something different, including maybe like a firmer reconciliation with Iran than Israel would like?
Yeah, I mean, I think even for the UAE, like the like rhetoric aside, they've already started talking to the Iranians again, and they've unfrozen money that they've given to the Iranians, basically to say, you know, let's not continue this fighting because it's disruptive for everybody. So I think even the UAE recognizes the reality that even if the Emiratis, the Emirati leadership wants to be, you know, firmly on the Israeli-U.S. side, like Iran is right there, and you can't ignore that. You can't wish that away. Mm-hmm. You have to deal with that on some level. But certainly for like Oman, which, you know, the other half of the Strait of Hormuz sits in Omani waters. Like if this is going to be an issue moving forward, they can't just shun Iran. And Omani foreign policy has never been, you know, big into to shunning even supposed bad actors. The Qataris, you know, they share their main gas field with Iran. Like, again, they can't just wish Iran away. They have to deal with the Iranians. So, you know, for those countries, definitely there's a hard reality that, you know, there's nothing to be done here. But I think it's been a wake-up call for everybody, like the Saudis too, you know, that Iran was able to attack them so thoroughly and so harshly, and was willing to do it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this was the new thing. It wasn't necessarily a revelation that Iran could attack the Gulf states, but that they did it, that was their main response to the war, like their main form of retaliation. It wasn't attacking Israel. It wasn't trying to, you know, hit a U.S. aircraft carrier or anything like that. It was attacking these Gulf states. Like, I don't think they were prepared for that level of retribution, and it's you know, doesn't sit well with them necessarily, but it's also a fact, a reality that they have to deal with. And you know,
yeah,
there's a cost to keeping these U.S. military bases. There's a cost to remaining on that pole and you know, staying hostile toward Iran.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, I guess in a way, maybe one of the main forces, if you imagine that the regime stays in place in Iran and the power dynamics continue, you know, like where they are now, which is that a lot of power shifted to Iran, as you've, one manifestation of which you've just described. Ironically, the main hope for keeping Israel to do whatever they want to do with the Palestinians, including literally, you know, get them to migrate to some country far, far away, is Iran. I mean, and I say ironically because, you know, it's not an Arab country, like, so it doesn't have that in common with the Palestinians. It's not a Sunni country, but because, you know, for historical reasons, it has come to have these alliances with Hamas and Hezbollah. Now, I would say, I'm curious what you think about this. So far, Iran hasn't seemed to be willing to jeopardize the peace deal very much in order to stand up for Hezbollah, right? There was some stuff early on, but this deal with the Lebanese government that basically legitimizes the Israeli occupation and of a significant part of Lebanon and has various other consequences that Iran doesn't welcome and God knows Hezbollah doesn't welcome. They haven't done really anything. Iran hasn't done anything forceful in response to that, right?
No, I mean, there's been a definite decrease in the intensity of Israeli bombardments in southern Lebanon. But yeah, the occupation hasn't ended. And there's some question as to whether, and one of the things that was debated, you know, early on after the MOU was signed was whether or not it required the IDF to withdraw from southern Lebanon. The Israelis, of course, say no. And now they've done this, you know, devil's bargain with the Lebanese government, or the Lebanese government has made the devil's bargain with Israel, rather, that, as you say, basically legitimizes the occupation, at least for the time being. And, it, you know, that weakens Iran's position to some degree. I think it's more a case of like, it hasn't gotten to that. There's been so much dispute over the more immediate concern for the Iranians, which is the Strait of Hormuz and their control over it, that it hasn't even gotten to the point where they're like debating the situation in Lebanon. It's breaking down over this even more fundamental concern. So, you know, it's just a question of like, there's only so many things you can, I mean, it's already broken down. Like, it can't break down twice, I guess. So it hasn't been an issue, but had, you know, if things were going smoothly in the Strait, would the Iranians be making a bigger deal out of Lebanon? Maybe. I can't, you know, can't say.
Yeah. I mean, as for the MOU, you know, there are two reasons you can leave ambiguity in one of those things. One is, as you said earlier, that then you can both read whatever you want into it. But of course, that's just a recipe for trouble. The other reason is because you don't want to explicitly admit to your public what you've done, but there is an understanding about what is going to be done. And that second thing is often like smart diplomacy, if you're going to do that. The first thing, again, is just a recipe for trouble. And I wonder which, to what extent that was actually the second one. And because if you read the MOU, it does say Iran can't collect tolls for 60 days and almost says it in a way that anticipates they will start doing
it. Right, they will do it after that.
It doesn't quite say that. Okay, fine. But it does pretty much convey, if not explicitly, like Iran's going to handle things in the Strait of Hormuz.
Right. I mean, the first sentence is the Islamic Republic of Iran will make arrangements for the safe passage of commercial vessels. I'm leaving out a couple of.
And even that doesn't have to happen for 30 days.
Right. I mean, they get 30 days to demine and, you know, get things to.
Yeah, Iran is committing to restore the traffic to its prior level within 30 days. And so it isn't like Iran has to free up the strait. It's like Iran is going to do some shit. And the only guarantee is in 30 days, things will be like this. And implicitly, if they're the ones doing the shit, they're in charge of the strait. And I'm sure Iran took it to mean we can, at a minimum, tell all the traffic they have to pass through our little thing, whether or not we're going to charge them. Now, I've heard reports that they're charging something, they're called. That would more clearly, to my mind, violate the terms of the MOU, I guess, to a lesser extent, if it's truly a trivial amount of money called something or other, and it's just to establish the mechanism of paying something. But what is your take? Are they paying something? I mean,
I haven't heard that. I haven't heard that they're making anybody pay anything. I mean, the reporting that I've seen has been that they're negotiating with the Omanis about what kind of system they could set up after this is, you know, this crisis is passed, if it ever does. And mostly that sounds to me like the Omanis have been trying to talk the Iranians down from some very maximalist positions, because what they were talking about, and they stopped talking about tolls because the word toll sets off a lot of, you know, alarm bells in international law and just generally with the US and other players. They've stopped using that term, but they were still talking about collecting like $40 billion a year from just basically imposing fees on ships to transit the strait, which is the same thing as a toll. You're just changing the wording a little bit to correspond better with international law. And that would be a hard pill, I think, for anybody to swallow. But what the New York Times reported, I think it was in the New York Times a few, like last week or maybe it was before that. I've been on vacation, so I'm losing track of time. But like what they were reporting was the discussion had shifted to, or not the discussion had shifted, but the Omanis were trying to shift the discussion toward what they termed a voluntary fee, which is similar to what's done is kind of similar to what the Turkish government does in the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus and going into the Black Sea. It's similar to what there's a consortium of countries around the Strait of Malacca that do this. Basically, it's like they offer services to ships that pass through those waterways. And in the Turkish case, if you stop at a port, a Turkish port, and avail yourselves of services, your fee is waived. But if you want to go through without stopping at a port, they do charge you something for upkeep, for maintaining like a rescue operation in case, you know, something goes wrong, or for maintaining like various things that you know, could be, you know, could be of use in a worst case scenario, I guess, for a ship passing through. In the case of Malacca, they provide these services, and if you want to use the services, then you can pay for them. But if you don't, you just pass through, I think, and it's fine. But it's not a huge moneymaker. I mean, it's used to establish the ability to like provide refueling services or rescue services or whatever might be needed. It's not a revenue driver. In the Iranians' case, it would be, I think, symbolic of, you know, kind of ratifying Iran's control with Oman, or maybe, you know, in cooperation with the other states of the region, control over traffic through the Strait. But this idea that they're going to come out of this with, you know, making vast amounts of money every year, I think that's a much harder lift. And it sounds like what the Omanis were doing was trying to get them to back off of that. I don't know if they've had any success with that, but, yeah. But you know, that seems to
I
be
mean,
the,
again, if
the
I'm
other
man,
position.
If I'm Iran, I just change the messaging. I say, look, you owe us however many hundreds of billions, plainly illegal
war. Yeah, it's reparations, right?
I mean, it's reparations, and we'll stop as soon as you give us the fucking money.
Right, right.
I mean, it's just so obvious to me. But, you know, it's funny. In some ways, we underestimate the sophistication of the Iranians. I mean, certainly the foreign policy establishment, I think, underestimates, partly because they're so committed to the crazy Muslims narrative. But in this case, I don't understand why that's not the message. And I also, the thing we'll never know is to what extent there were implicit understanding, I mean, explicit but private understandings, right, about the degree of their control of the Strait. Because with Trump and his crew, you just never know. I mean,
yeah,
you know, who fucking knows? They're so incompetent. But anyway, so this is thoroughly depressing. We won't move on to Ukraine and get further depressed. I would say there's a on our feed, I just posted a few days ago, a conversation with this guy, Leonid Rogozin, who's very good. Have you ever had him on or read his
stuff? We haven't, no.
Shit, he's good. He's
okay.
He's from Russia, but based in Latvia, and he's, you know, I think he's truly committed to the journalistic ethos of just trying to be as clear as possible stuff, you know, definitely no Putin fan, but very capable of understanding how things look at from Russia's point of view. You should listen to it and see what you think, but I think he'd be a good guest.
That's a good idea.
So anyway,
we were just talking about needing to do another Ukraine episode.
He's there. Yeah. He's there. Tell him I sent you.
All right.
I can give you his coordinates if you want. All right. So
yeah, that'd be great.
Rate and review. This is going to be on both of our feeds, right?
Yeah.
And American Prestige and Non-Zero. And also check out Foreign Exchanges. Derek's excellent Substack.
Part of the Non-Zero Network.
Non-Zero Network, so, which means if you're a paid subscriber to either Non-Zero or the Foreign Exchanges, you get a 50% discount on one of your subscriptions to the other. And I don't know what else people could ask for in life, honestly.
Really? I mean, you know.
They're just such fucking malcontents. You know, you offer them something like this, and they're like, oh, you know, war, AI. It's like, what do you want? You've got this. Carpe diem.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Well, this is a lot of fun, and I hope illuminating.
Yeah, thanks, Bob.
All right. Thank you, Derek.